appreciate the privilege of you allowing me to take time and look at history together. I think it's a necessary thing as we look at our origins and define where we are, and hopefully a little bit about where we are going. But we come to this place and the account of Israel, we find that things are not going well in the land. There are disasters that are going on. There have been floods and famine. And the amazing thing is that the people of God are comfortable in their homes, and they're looking at all the things around them, and they're saying, if only the world around us would see. If only the leaders would see. If only the nations outside of us would see. They would know that God is speaking. But God had a message for the children of Israel. We find it in verse 2. He says, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came to little, and when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts? Because mine house that is waste, and ye run every man unto his own house. We find at this point in the resettling of the land of Israel that one of their primary focuses and goals was to rebuild the temple. The wall had been built. People had come in and they got comfortable where they were. May I say this tonight, folks, that it is easy for us as we look at all that's going on and we say, why can't people see? Why won't the government see? Why won't people around us see? Oh, this virus, it's a pestilence from God. The natural disasters that come, and we point our fingers everywhere but inside the church. What was God's message to his people? He said, you are in sealed houses. What is the idea of that? Their houses were built and finished. They were living in the comfort of their homes. And yet, the temple of God was just at its foundation. Folks, we live in an age where the church has grown comfortable. We've grown comfortable with our programs within, programs that may reach out. We're comfortable to come and sit in our pews or our chairs. We're comfortable to hear a message preached. But we point our fingers outside when we see God moving in ways that we look at and say it is obvious that God's hand of judgment is moving on our nation, and we don't stop and look within ourselves and say, maybe God is getting our attention. You see, we are in a place now where, yes, there are going to be similar battles fought as were fought in the early 20th century and the late 19th century. But folks, we are in a far worse condition The people of God have grown comfortable. We no longer have men like the tribe of Issachar, men who what? Knew the times and knew what to do. And I implore you tonight, as God's people, as members of Cross Point Baptist Church, a church that has historically stood on the Word of God for the fundamentals of the faith, for true, sound doctrine, that folks, we wake up and we step outside of our sealed houses and we begin to look at the world around us, that we begin to become knowledgeable about what is going on, that we begin a resurgence of learning Bible doctrine and loving the Word of God, because if we don't, the church is going to slip away. I have two articles that I'd like to read to you in introduction tonight. They may shock you. The first is entitled this, Atheists in Praise of Christianity. It says this, historian Tom Holland is known primarily as a storyteller of the ancient world. Thus, his newest book, Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World, came as something as a surprise for several reasons. First, Tom Holland is not a Christian. Second, Holland's book is one of the most ambitious historical defenses of Christianity in a very long time. I want you to listen to this. While studying the ancient world, Holland writes, he realized something. Simply, the ancients were cruel and their values utterly foreign to him. The Spartans routinely murdered imperfect children. The bodies of slaves were treated like outlets for the physical pleasure of those with power. Infanticide was common. The poor and the weak had no rights. How did we get from there to here? It was Christianity, Holland writes. Christianity revolutionized sex and marriage, demanding that men control themselves and prohibiting all forms of immorality and rape. Christianity confined sexuality within monogamy. It is ironic, Holland notes, that these are now the very standards for which Christianity is derided. Christianity elevated women. In short, Christianity utterly transformed the world. In fact, Holland points out that without Christianity, the Western world would not exist. Even the claims of the social justice warriors who despise the faith of their ancestors rest on a foundation of Judeo-Christian values. Those who make arguments based on love, tolerance, and compassion are borrowing from fundamentally Christian arguments. If the West had not become Christian, Holland writes, no one would have gotten woke. Holland's book length, Defense of the Belief System of the Elites, Love to Despise, has unsurprisingly attracted some criticism. He faced off with militant atheist and prominent philosopher A.C. Grayling on the question, did Christianity give us our human values? Grayling struggled to rebut Holland, sounding more petty than philosophical. Holland, on the other hand, became positively passionate in his defense of Christianity. If Western civilization is the fishbowl, he stated, then the water is Christianity. While many, including Holland, cannot quite bring themselves to believe Christianity is true, they are starting to believe that Christianity might be necessary. Think of that. In fact, the very critics of those who condemn Christianity for various perceived injustices are rooted in Christian precepts. Holland's passionate defense of Christianity is fascinating because it appears to be part of a trend. As the West becomes definitively post-Christian, many secularists are suddenly realizing that Christianity may have been more valuable than they thought. While many, including Holland, cannot quite bring themselves to believe Christianity is true, they are starting to believe that Christianity might be necessary. Douglas Murray, the conservative author and columnist, is also an atheist. In recent years, however, he has started to warn that the decline of Christianity is a dangerous thing. Now listen to what he says. Society now faces three options. First, Murray says, is to reject the idea that all human life is precious. Second is to work furiously to nail down an atheist version of the sanctity of the individual. That's not going to happen. And if that doesn't work, then there is only one other place to go, which is back to faith, whether we like it or not. Murray now occasionally refers to himself as a Christian atheist. Speaking with Esther O'Reilly on the Unbelievable podcast, Murray lauded the revolutionary moral insights of Christianity. He told her that while visiting the Sea of Galilee, notice this, he couldn't shake the feeling that something happened here. Can I just say, when you go to Israel as a believer, it will affirm in your heart what happened there. And he admitted that as atheists consider morality, the more we may have to accept that the sanctity of human life is a Judeo-Christian notion which might very easily not survive the disappearance of Judeo-Christian civilization. Speaking on the Darren Grimes show last month, he was even blunter. There seems to be little point in life spent talking about Labor Party politics rather than God. The phenomenon of atheists praising Christianity appears to be growing. Gone are the days when Christopher Hitchens, a good friend of Murray's, and his fellow secularists raged against the poison of religion. Even Richard Dawkins has now admitted that Christianity might be the preferable alternative. After we look at what is going on in society right now, wouldn't you agree? He once called for Christianity to be destroyed. Now he begrudgingly says it has good effects on society. There is also Jordan Peterson, the famous psychologist, refuses to say whether he believes in God, or at least he refuses to say what he means by God or Christ or faith. Peterson is attempting to synthesize scriptures with Jung and Darwin, and the result is predictably tortured. But Peterson knows that without Christianity, unspeakable cruelty is inevitable. He speaks like a secular Calvinist. He believes in human depravity, but has not yet worked out redemption. Charles Murray, the American social scientist and sociologist, is an agnostic, yet he told me in an interview that he believes the American Republic will not survive without a resurgence of Christianity. You cannot have a free society with a constitution like the American one unless you are trying to govern a religious people, he observed. Do you hear what these atheists are writing and saying? Folks, we need to wake up. We need to look at the world around us. The late Sir Roger Scruton, too, headed back to church. He struggled with many of Christianity's truth claims, but still he came to believe that Christianity was necessary. While nursing doubts, he played the organ in his local Anglican church during Sunday services. Perhaps practice, he once said, would help him along. He wasn't sure he could believe it all, but he wanted to. These men are King Agrippa phenomenon. As King Agrippa told the Apostle Paul, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian, they almost believe it. They believe Christianity is good, and some believe it necessary. As Murphy put it, he believes in belief, but they cannot yet bring themselves to believe that it is literally true, that Jesus Christ actually rose from the dead. These strange struggles also deliver a warning to the West. Without Christianity, we are heading into a thick and impenetrable darkness. Christianity gave us human rights. It gave us protection for the weak, compassion rooted in commands to love, forgiveness for enemies. It revolutionized the world, and we are now in the process of undoing that revolution. In fact, we are replacing it with the sexual revolution. We should look at what we are destroying before we carry on. We should ask why fences were built before tearing them down. We should listen to the atheists nervously telling us that Christianity is necessary. What a scary thought. Isn't it amazing how 100 years later, as we fought battles against liberalism and modernism that was trying to take away Christianity, now the atheists are the strongest evangelists for the Christian cause? I don't know whether to rejoice or to be ashamed. What are we going to do with it? Folks, we're living in our sealed houses. Are we just simply content to have programs, to have ministries, to have missions? We give toward those things, and that is good and right. But what are we doing as believers to fight the fight of society? Even the atheists see that society is on the demise. And where are the ones who can speak up and give the true message? The atheists can't. Why? Because they don't believe it. They're in a quandary. But we have the truth. You see why these battles are so important. Another article is written by Al Mohler. He is a Southern Baptist, but he has a very good grasp on what is going on in society. This is an excerpt from his book, The Gathering Storm, Secularism, Culture, and the Church. He says this: by the end of the 20th century, the impact of theological liberalism was seen in almost every denomination. Now, he is talking about the 1990s, not the 1890s. The demands for an updated theology and morality, for Christianity to be redefined for a secular age, were reshaping seminaries, congregations, Christian schools, and denominations. Note this: most of the old mainline denominations had capitulated by the 70s. Tellingly, even as the prophets of theological liberalism had promised that liberalism would save their churches, it was actually liberal theology that led to the evacuation of those churches and denominations. They were saying in the 1910s and 1920s that we are going to revolutionize the church. We're going to make it relevant. We're going to have people who are highly educated. Where was that education coming from? It was coming from the modernistic liberal theology that was coming out of Europe after the Enlightenment and rationalization. You see, their membership and attendance plummeted. As recently as 2018, one liberal denomination in Canada predicted that by 2040, it would have no members, no attendees, no givers. This was even the truth in the Southern Baptist Convention until conservatives were able to redirect the denomination in the last years of the 20th century. As the present century dawned, secular trends in the society were well documented, and a general religious decline marked many denominations of their culture. Conservative, biblically committed Christians faced a new set of challenges. We spoke of this man, J. Gresham Machen, the Presbyterian theologian from the early decades of the 20th century. Century brilliantly assessed the state of modern Christianity and the rise of Protestant liberalism. rather than seeing liberal theology as a variant of the Christian faith, Macon labeled it as a totally new religion that merely poses as Christianity. For Macon, nothing unified Orthodox Christianity with liberalism. The former pursued theological fidelity to the God of the Bible, while the latter morphed into an entirely new religion. He titled his famous book, Christianity and Liberalism, and made it clear that liberalism was an entirely new and separate religion altogether. Now we see that liberalism and secularization have merged, creating a new and dangerous context for biblically committed Christians. And rightly so, he states this: the new context will reveal the true followers of Christ. And they may well be revealed by the fact that they are the last in our culture to remember what authentic Christianity is. That is a scary statement. The fusion of secularization with liberal Protestantism made liberal theology more normal in the eyes of culture. For secular culture does not even need a secular theology. They want no theology at all. But because of secularization's effect, liberal theology sometimes even infiltrates churches that think themselves to be committed to theological orthodoxy. Listen to these statements. Secularism has desensitized many people sitting in the pews of faithful gospel-preaching churches, leading them to unwittingly hold even heretical doctrines. It is frightening to realize that some people can be so effectively secularized even when regularly attending church. How? The fact is that many Christians will be hard-pressed to define faithful Christianity or to live and define central and eternal doctrines. What is he saying? He is saying we need to be people of the book. He's saying we need to be people who know our doctrine and our theology. We need to be people who can get into a conversation with a postmodern thinker and not walk away defeated. Folks, we have a tremendous responsibility. The late 1920s through the 30s, as these battles were raging, the first stage, fundamentalist separatism, amounted to an attempt to separate liberals from their organizations. Having failed, fundamentalists resorted to a second stage and were forced to separate themselves from the liberals in a formal practice of ecclesiastical separation. Fundamentalist efforts to cleanse denomination of liberal trends had seemed to fail. Rather than persisting along the 1920s lines of conflict, fundamentalists during the 30s were developing their own institutional base from which to carry on their major purpose, the proclamation of the evangelical gospel. So what were they doing? They were fighting for truth within. And folks, the Bible has something to say about our fighting for truth. Number one, which was on the screen and now it's disappeared. Hopefully it'll come back up, but you can write this down. We should call out the teacher by name. We should call them out by name. You see, we have to identify those who are teaching error. Paul certainly had no problem doing this, and he instructed those who follow him to do the very same thing. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 9 and 10 say this: do thy diligence to come shortly unto me, for Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed unto Thessalonica, Crescens to Galatia, Titus unto Dalmatia. In 2 Timothy 1 and verse 15, he says this: this thou knowest, that all they which are in Asia be turned away from me, of whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 18, or 19 and 20, holding faith and a good conscience, which some having put away concerning the faith have made shipwreck, of whom is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme. You see, folks, we are called to identify false ideas. We're called to publicly expose those who are either living by or teaching others those ideas. We have got to be people of the book so that we can identify those that would lead us astray. And Paul was doing that in his day and time. But not only should we call out the teacher by name, we should describe the teaching. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 16 through 18. It says, "But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness, and their word will eat as doth a canker, of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus, who concerning the truth have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some." We need to describe the teaching. You see what Paul is doing there? He's describing it very graphically, profane and vain babblings. What do? They increase unto more ungodliness. They eat as doth a canker. It's like that gangrenous sore on the top of the skin, and the longer it is left to fester, the deeper it eats. You see, we're called to know the truth well enough to see the lie coming, and to describe the lie to others so that they can be warned. Listen, when false teaching comes into your path, are you seeing it? When false teaching comes into your path, we shouldn't just be saying, you know, something's just not right about that. Folks, we ought to be students of the Word enough that we can identify it. And that comes from knowing the spirit of the age. We should describe the teaching. And then we should do all that we can to silence the teacher. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 10, it says, "For there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcisions, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses, teaching things which they ought not for filthy lucre's sake." 2 John, the Apostle John says this, "Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he hath both the Father and the Son. If there come only unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed, for he that biddeth him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds." How do we receive those who are false teachers? Can't just say, folks, that leaving TBN on all day ain't good for you. All right, I'm sorry if that makes you mad. But the Trinity Broadcasting Network is not the best thing for a Bible-believing Christian to listen to and to watch. And you definitely don't need to send Mike Murdoch your seed money, because the only thing it's growing is his bank account. Now, I know I'm naming names and I'm being sarcastic, but folks, we have to wake up. They're false teachers, and they're all around us. We find them on YouTube. We find them in books. And I would implore you, don't get angry when you hear from the pulpit, when you hear your pastors, when you hear your leaders naming names and talking about false doctrine. We do it because that's what the shepherd does for his sheep. He watches after the flock and he protects them. And folks, we as believers need to listen. And then we as believers need to be prepared. Listen, fathers, you are the shepherds of your homes. You are the leaders of your family. You ought to be readers. You ought to know your doctrine. And you ought to know what is going on in this world, because your children are going to face it, and they need to face it prepared. We have to do all we can to silence them. And then we should refute their teaching. We should refute their teaching. Titus 1 says this, "For a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not angry, not given to wine, no striker, not given to filthy lucre, but a lover of hospitality, a lover of good men, sober, just, holy, temperate, holding fast the faithful word as he hath been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convince the gainsayers." The pastor needs to live a holy life, one that is separated, one that is in the Word. But can I say, folks, that the pastor is a human being and is no different from the people. And the people ought to be students of the Word as well. You ought to be able to convince the gainsayers. Verse 13, it goes on to say this, "This witness is true, wherefore rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith." And so as these men were doing battle in the 20s, they were doing all of these things. They understood their Bible. They fought hard for doctrine. And I want to remind you, folks, this was not just preachers and professors. These were Sunday school teachers that were fighting these battles, and church members as well. And so I ask you tonight, as we consider these things, are we content to live in our sealed houses? We look around us, and folks, we are almost scrubbed down to the foundation as far as churches are concerned. I wish we had time to look into the polls to see the decline in the attendance at church. It is a shame where faithfulness in many polls has to be defined as attendance at church twice, I believe, in a month. That is considered faithful church attendance by the pollsters. That's a shame. We are scrubbed down to the foundation. What are we going to do? Folks, we cannot sit in our seats. We can't stay in our sealed houses. We need to be people of the Word who are taking the Word to a society who desperately needs it. Listen, President Trump could come to salvation. The entirety of the Senate and the Congress could come to salvation. Our city fathers could come to salvation. But folks, that is not what is going to change society. It's not just the leaders. It is the church of God. Now praise the Lord if they would. But it's the church of God. That is God's pillar and ground of the truth. That is God's program for this dispensation in which we live. And folks, we have got to get out of our sealed houses, and we have got to be proclaimers of the truth. We have got to stand for the truth. Because as the atheists see it, our society is going away. And we are on the verge of utter darkness. What will you do with your faith? These men were earnestly contending. And praise God that they did, because we got another 100 years. of the joys that we have had in good Bible-believing churches. And my question is, are we willing to fight and do what we should so that we can secure another 100 years for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? May God help us as we do that. May God stir in our hearts men who will pick up a book and read, men who will pick up their Bible and read it, men who will pick up a theology book and read it, and even though they don't understand it, they ask questions. That's real Christianity. May God help us preserve what we have, and not just preserve it, but may He send a revival through His people, and may it start with us here.